Hello and welcome to Beyond Organic Wine. I'm Adam Huss, coming to you from California, from a very special ranch called Piscinas Ranch. Thank you so much for listening, and a special thanks to those of you who support this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, things like donations and subscribing to our Patreon make this podcast possible. And links for those things are in the show notes. And other things like giving a great review and telling other people about it helped make this podcast possible in different ways because it reaches more people. Also, I'd love to connect with you personally if you feel like dropping me a line at connect@organicwinepodcast.com. Please keep listening at the end of this conversation. If you're interested in another book recommendation, I say another because I did this at the end of the last episode, gave some book recommendations. And I'm also going to save some of my thoughts that I'd like to share for the end of this episode as well. But they are tied into why John, my guest for this episode, has to do what he's doing. And now that I've said his name, if you haven't heard of Dr. Jonathan Lundgren and ecdysis, you are in for a treat. John is from the middle of this country and has seen the return of dust storms to our nation's farmland. Not a great thing to see in our time. It hasn't happened since the 1930s when we had a really bad thing known as the Dust Bowl. Strangely, however, he is extremely hopeful and optimistic, and you're going to find out why. John was one of the preeminent scientists in his field, but when he looked around at the farmland that he would pass as he drove for hours through the Midwest, he saw that none of his achievements were making a difference. He wanted to affect positive change, like most of you listening, who see what is happening to our world. He wanted to make it better, and so he did. I don't want to overhype him or the work that he's doing, but it may be unique in the history of the world. Ecdysis is undertaking one of, if not the largest science project of its kind ever. Known as the 1,000 Farms Initiative, the folks at Ecdysis visit and collect data from what will soon be over 1,000 farms, including vineyards and orchards. Of course, he isn't doing this work alone. There's a team of passionate, intelligent people who make this project possible. This data he has been collecting shows the ecological, economic, environmental, sociological, and psychological results of different types of farming practices. And as John and the Ecdysis team collect more and more data over more and more years, the results provide an avalanche of evidence that not only makes it clear that regenerative agriculture is the solution, but also provides the basis for policy and laws to change and adapt to the undeniable evidence. I'll let John take it from here, but keep listening after the conversation for some additional thoughts, and enjoy. John, welcome. Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Yes.
Now that you know what you're doing, can you introduce yourself and the work that you do with Blue Dasher and the Ecdysis Foundation?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm John Lundgren. I'm the executive director of Ecdysis Foundation, and I'm owner and operator with Christina Lind of Blue Dasher Farm here in South Dakota, about as far away from wine country as you can get. But
oh, you'd be surprised. I just had some wine from Kindred North Dakota.
Yeah. No, yeah. We actually have a mini vinny that we started on Blue Dasher Farm. So we're all in. That's just
nice.
Yeah, a well kept secret is what we are.
Gotcha. Did you say mini vinny?
Yeah, mini vineyard. Yeah,
like that.
about 40 vines or so. And
that's great. What are you growing?
Stuff that grows here. So yeah. Christina would be able to list them all off, and gotcha. It's my job to get the sticks in the ground and the trellising up and keep my mouth shut is really what my job is.
Nice. You're the hired hand, the labor. Yep. Right on. Well, you also work, you have a love of bees. You are an entomologist by trade.
I am in a former life, and maybe a life I'll someday get back to. I don't know, but I was Yeah, I'm a bug guy. So insects were a big part of my life and still are in a lot of ways. I still think they're a great character for telling the story of life and the story of the environment and farming.
And I'm going to ask you about that, but I want to, just when we're on bees, I know you keep bees and make honey. Have you considered making some mead with that?
Yeah, we do. We make our own mead here. And in fact, we work with a local brewery. They make a sizer that's a really great brew up in Watertown, South Dakota. And then we have our own mead that we've been playing around with and different flavors and stuff. And I think we're at a stage now where we're probably going to start bottling it up.
Oh, fantastic. Anything sticking out in terms of flavors that you're blending with?
We use a wild yeast that seems to give a really nice flavor, but then they've been every few days or so, maybe every couple of weeks, the girls start bringing in little shot glasses of things that they've been playing around with. I like the hot pepper mead.
Oh, wow.
That was one of the ones that really stuck out to me. It's got a little bit of a kick, but it's not too sweet, and it really is nice.
Nice. I love that. That sounds great. Well, and
our bees are really special. They're like, we don't feed them anything but honey and the prairie. So this honey that comes off is just like one of a kind. It's exactly like wine, you know. We think of terroir and all of these things. Man, the more that I've... So we've worked in vineyards out in California for a few years now. And the more that I've learned from the farmers and just the industry in general, the more that I think it's so true of, you know, I mean, how in vineyards we think of you know, every vineyard having its own sort of, and the soils and everything having its own flavor, that which is of that place. And it really strikes me how applicable that is to every farm product, really.
Yeah.
From the meat that we raise here on Blue Dasher Farm to the honey to the, I mean, you can, every farm has a stamp.
Yeah.
And I recently was in Italy, and a friend of mine, Gary Nabham, he's a writer and a Franciscan monk and one of the smartest guys I know.
I actually interviewed him for an episode of this podcast.
Did you really?
Yeah.
He's really great, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
Well, we were in Italy and he said, there's a concept that they used to have here that's maybe coming back in Italy, campanilismo, which means within the sound of church bells. And every town had such a pride in its food and its local food, right?
Right.
And because that food was produced within that sound of a church bell. And we lost that, you know, with the industrialization of our food system. But it does feel like it's coming back a little bit. That pendulum is swinging.
Yeah, it does. I raised bees in my backyard in Los Angeles for a few years. And I just remember, you know, we have obviously like tons of crazy exotic flowers year round there. So I would just see, you know, you see as you're harvesting the honey, the color changes, everything changes, like, you know, month to month, you're getting a whole different spectrum of colors and flavors and things as the season, you know, different things are in bloom. And yeah, it's really fun.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Our honey comes off and it does, it tastes like a flower, but it goes hard, like almost instantly. Yeah. I'm not sure which flower, because we just get the legs and wings out. The rest, it's all raw. And and so it crystallizes pretty rapidly, but it applies like honey or like frosting so we have to explain to people that, you know, this is the honey that you buy at the grocery store actually isn't honey. It comes from India and China, and it's adulterated rice sugar for the most part. So this is real honey. And they're often remark, gosh, I normally don't like honey, but this is very good. That's because we've never eaten honey.
Have you... Do you have any, I mean, as somebody who probably has a much deeper knowledge of bees than I do, you have any interesting facts, like, or fascinating things about bees that you've learned working with them or just from studying them?
Oh my gosh. Every time we open the hive, I think you learn something new. It's a box filled with, you know, 10,000 stinging insects, and they allow you into their world. And it's a magical experience every single time. What gets me is the personality of the hives, and how just like any other livestock, that hive gets to know you and trust you, and that's a weird thing, isn't it? You don't think of insects as having that capability, but it's absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah. I've told this story on the podcast before, but it's something I noticed, and maybe you can fill me in if I'm, you know, thinking about this correctly, but, you know, they always talk about bees as a super organism. And I started noticing that they were swarming, like when we would get rain and they would swarm. But then I started thinking about, like, how long it takes to breed a queen. And that would mean they knew it was going to rain, you know, weeks in advance, it seems like, you know. And I started thinking about, like, their connection to the environment is so nuanced and so, you know, I mean, it's not even a connection. I mean, they are the environment is what I realized. Yeah. Like, they are, the super organism is much bigger than just the hive. It's the whole environment that they live in. Yeah, and
for sure. Yeah. And they're great bellwether, aren't they? Because they touch so many different facets of the environment and they bring it all back into their hive, it kind of tells you what's happening within that habitat, you know, just by watching those bees.
Yeah. Yeah. And, a lot of our farming practices are really harmful to them. Neonics are really bad for them. Pesticides actually kill bees.
Yeah.
I just heard you a fact that you brought up about the neonicotinoids that are on all of the commercial corn and soybean, wheat. I imagine wheat seed as well, that's grown in the U.S. And like over 10% of our land area is dedicated to these crops, with, if you throw in cotton. What is the statistic about how many things could be killed by what's on one single seed?
Well, neonicotinoids are, I mean, they're marketed as this kind of a good thing, in that the amount of active ingredient that ends up going out into the environment is actually comparatively low relative to other pesticides or insecticides. But the reason for that is because they're extremely toxic and they're very persistent in the environment, and therefore they work very well and go away very quickly. So one seed, we did some math once, and one corn seed has enough insecticide to kill 164,000 bees.
Wow. So that's,
it's basically just like a grain of salt. The lethal dose for a bee is essentially equates to about a grain of salt in a swimming pool, like an Olympic size swimming pool. Wow. That's how toxic these things are.
And how many corn seeds are planted per acre? Do you know any sense of that?
Tens of thousands.
Yeah. That's a lot of death being dealt out. So this is, just for anybody who's not familiar, this is like a powder coating on the seed that is on every, like, so if you're not on organic corn, of course, I'm assuming. But if you're not eating organic corn, any other corn product, basically, the production of it was what we're talking about. It used this kind of corn that's coated with this amount of poison. Is that correct?
Yeah.
For me? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, and it doesn't just affect bees, right?
Right.
I mean,
we're living through
the insect apocalypse right now. In fact, it's not even just an insect apocalypse, it's an apocalypse of life as we know it.
Seems like that amount of stuff in our food system would affect us. It's ultimately, it does, as well.
Yeah, we did a risk assessment on white-tailed deer a number of years ago. Elise Hughes Berheim, one of my graduate students, did, and this stuff, it monkeyed up the deer's it had lower or greater fawn mortality, So it was killing the fawns. It was disrupting the fawns' growth and metabolism, the thyroid hormone levels, morphological deformities, and its learning disabilities, right? I mean, all of these things we can say, okay, that sounds like what's happening to the bees. But when you really look at it, that's what's happening to us right now as a species.
Yep.
We need to be connecting the dots here.
Well, I mean, you've alluded to this, but what is the importance of insects in general, not just bees, but like, I know we talk about bees, but you know, like in a vineyard, like vineyards aren't being pollinated by bees, but there's certainly a lot of insects in and around a healthy vineyard. I mean, do you have any data about the importance of insects to us and to our food systems, our beverage systems?
Yeah. I mean, how long is your show? Our interface with insects is usually through pest management, isn't it? You know, and that's true of most biodiversity. We interface with the pests, the things we don't like, and all of our management focuses on those pests and those things that we don't like. But when we put on those blinders, we forget how important life is in so many different. Yeah, I mean, we can't exist without insects. They provide, you know, I mean, if you want to get on the economical side, what an entomologist usually hauls out when you're talking about the benefits of bugs is, okay, you know, pollination services and pest management services and food for wildlife and dung recycling and stuff. And you can put a number of, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year that insects end up contributing to the U.S. economy alone. But that doesn't do it justice, right?
Right.
I mean, the colors and the smells and the tastes of our world, that's because of insects. I mean, plants evolved countless mechanisms for either attracting or pushing away bugs. Right. And we've harnessed those things, right? Your spice cabinet, all of those spices, all of those flavors that we come to love, those are basically plant secondary compounds designed to deter herbivory by insects. The flowers out there, that isn't for us, right? All those colors. Flowers are trying to attract their pollinator suite and so on and so forth. So biodiversity is just so much a part of being human, isn't it?
Well, I would like it to be. Yes. More of that would be great. I've heard something also about the nutrient cycling, that insects are part of, that it's sure. Like some massive number of like the amount of like nitrogen, for example, that's in the world is cycled through insects. Do you know anything about that?
Well, carbon is another important carbon. One. Everybody likes to talk about carbon these days. But a lot of the organic matter in soil that's insect poop, right? In terms of breaking down plant material and other organic material poop, that's bugs. They're the first line of defense there. They make it bioavailable to the microbial community. So insects are just critical in this whole concept of soil health.
Well, maybe we should step back and I just want you to sort of explain what you do with the Ecdysis Foundation. Maybe talk about the Thousand Farms Initiative. Because I think let's just start with that. What are you doing?
It's a little crazy, isn't it? Yeah. So Ecdysis, I worked with USDA for a long time, right? And at that time in my life, one of my life's goals was professional goals was to be the best entomologist in the world. And, you know, by at least a few metrics, I wasn't too far off. I did things pretty well. We had this list of metrics of success that I could, you know, chase after, and nobody had better stats than I did. I got to meet the president in the White House for being one of the top scientists in the country.
Huh.
But I could drive from here to my folks' place in Minneapolis, and I was working in agriculture, but all of my research that I thought was really useful wasn't helping anybody. I mean, things weren't getting better. Climates aren't getting better. The farming communities weren't getting better. We were losing life at a more rapid clip than the planet's ever experienced before. Rural communities are declining, human health. And it was just like, you know, this isn't working. And science is a part of that breakdown, right?
How so?
And well, did you say how so?
Yes. Yeah.
It's supported the current infrastructure of our food system, right? I mean, science is hell-bent on getting 3 more bushels to the acre and or solving that, you know, one new pest that happened to blow in from someplace else. And so we never really rethink systems. We're not using science in that way. What we're using is science is used to support the current system. And so I sort of said, we need to revise agriculture, and science has to be rethought, at least how it's applied. And so I quit and started Ecdysis Foundation. And the first thing that I said is that in agriculture, if scientists are intending to help with farming or the farming communities, then you know what? We have to walk a mile in their shoes. And so I bought the farm. We bought Blue Dasher Farm at the same time as we started Ecdysis. And Blue Dasher Farm is an operating regenerative farm here in South Dakota, but it's also a training ground. And all of our scientific staff have to participate and help on the farm so that they have firsthand experience with what a farmer is going through. And that just changed everything.
Huh. So, and there is the Thousand Farms Initiative that you are...
Right,
ambitious, really crazily ambitious goal that actually you're getting pretty close to having included or gathered data from that many farms already.
So regenerative farming seems to have a lot of promise, right? And yeah, I'm preaching to the choir here a little bit. But there's a lot of... What's that?
I would love to hear why you think that too. I mean, you're probably in a better place than anybody just to talk about that.
Well, it's because I've seen it and I've felt it with all of my senses. You know, when you walk onto a regenerative farm, I mean, it's different. And my job is now to turn that feeling that we get. I mean, when I bring the staff out to a regenerative farm or a conventional farm, right, I don't tell them which is which, but I can tell you that when we're on a regenerative farm, the staff laughs more, the morale goes up, the we get more work done faster. Huh. And there's this is going to sound hippy-dippy, coming from a scientist, right? This is crazy. There's a spirit about a healthy farm. And that maybe that spirit is, you know, my brain going out there and taking in with all of my senses, okay, the relative noise factor, the bioacoustics that are happening are coming into my ears, and the smells of the flowers or the plant diversity and all of the secondary plant compounds and the tastes within my mouth and the feeling of the air or the leaves and the sights and the reflectance of certain spectra are hitting me, and my brain is taking all of these signals at once and it's turning it into a feeling that says good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my job to turn all of that into a number that we can then use to compare, and we can explain to somebody that's never been on a regenerative farm that this is real and it's quantifiable and it's transferable and it's replicable.
So that's what
the Thousand Farms is. We're conducting probably one of the largest research experiments that's ever been done on agriculture. we're reaching out to farmers across North America at this point and globally soon. And we're practicing, yeah, we measure them, right? We measure their farms. We look at the soils. We look at the water. We look at the life, the bioinventories, birds, bugs, plants, microbes, fungi. We look at the economics. We look at the management. We look at the nutrient content of the yields. We look at the health, and we look at the wellness and the mental state of the farmers for all of these fields. And we've done this now on 737 farms, and we are slated for another 500 this year. So
you will exceed 1,000.
Yeah, you know, I just didn't want to change the letterhead every time we landed at a farm.
Yeah. Well, what are you finding? How long have you been doing this, first of all?
2 years.
That's it?
Yeah, this will be our third year.
So what are you finding?
That the promises of regenerative agriculture, I think, are real. I mean, this is the answer to a lot of problems that we're facing right now. We can offset our global, or our nation's carbon emissions using our food system. We can reverse desertification in the Central Valley while still producing food there. We can reverse biodiversity loss by increasing life on these farms sixfold or more compared to an industrialized system. We can make farmers more resilient. We can make farming communities return, the rural fabric of our society return, and be that again, right? That what it was designed to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean,
what about profitability? How does that factor into?
Yeah, right. So we've measured profitability. You don't lose money by going to regenerative. And depending on the system, you usually gain money. What's interesting, though, is that on a national average, and this is messy data, okay, because this is real data. This isn't done on an experiment farm, and it's not highly controlled. We have controls and all of that. It's experimentally sound, but it's just a reflection of the real world, and that's messy. What you see is that if you want predictability of income, you farm conventionally, okay? You know what's going in, you know what's coming out. It's a dialed in system. With regenerative, because of where we are in this movement right now, in every single system that we examined, the most profitable and highest yielding farm was regenerative. Right. Problem is that the lowest producing and the lowest economics or profitability was also regenerative. And what that suggests to me is that, you know, there's a lot of currencies that are out there right now, and economics isn't necessarily, yes, we all have to be profitable and make ends meet, but that doesn't seem to be the primary driver of a lot of regenerative farmers. The currencies that they value might be family. They might be, maybe they experienced a health crisis or some other crisis in their life, and this was the answer. Maybe it's the legacy. Maybe it's respect for the land. Maybe it's the sense of community that they feel. Those are the drivers, I think. And we'll be able to tease that out more quantifiably with this year's survey's results. But I think that should say a lot.
Yeah. What I should ask, I know you wrote a paper about this, so I'm guessing you have some thoughts about it. How do you identify or define regenerative farming?
Yeah. For us,
I'm guessing there's a spectrum too in all farms that you're
right on. Yeah. So in 2 minutes, of talking with you about 9 or 10 yes or no questions, I can make predictions about what we're going to find on your farm in terms of greenhouse gas sequestration, life promotion, water infiltration, your happiness, things like this. 2 minutes.
Wow. Yeah.
We've designed a set of proxy questions that are just simple yes and no questions that seem to be indicators of many other facets of the farm. And so, yeah, that's how we kind of do at least our initial assessments, is just to figure out, we call them the matrix question. and so, essentially, no tillage, keeping the ground cover present, plant diversity is really important. The backing off of synthetics, applying some of the organic amendments and things like that to your soils. And for rangelands, it's keeping high density, moving them frequently and letting it rest. Very simple, right?
Yeah.
And that's published on, anybody can use it. There could even be, like, you know, labeling schemes and all of this, but that's not our job, right? But that doesn't really get at what a regenerative farm is, right? I mean, it does and it doesn't. what it becomes is, it's a reflection. Right. I asked 2 general questions, and if we want to attain what's possible in a regenerative operation, you got to say yes to both of these. The first is, have human feet touched every acre of your farm? And the other one is, are you growing food for your family and your community? Do you eat what it is that you're growing? And there's a lot to unpack with both of those questions.
Yeah.
Scale. What you're producing, how you're producing it.
Would you expand that to say, are you producing wine for your family and community? Would that achieve the same results, probably?
I think so, but I don't think that wine producers should just produce wine. You got a lot of bare ground in there, you know. Let's get those sheep in there. Let's diversify what it is that we're doing. I understand the need for specialization, but I also think that wine is just one component of the food system, and an operating farm needs to balance that.
Yep, that's great. Have you differentiated in your data collection between perennial and annual crop systems? Like, you know, and again, I'm sort of leading into any data, you know, the data that has been collected specifically from vineyards or orchards where fruit is grown for, you know, fermentation. But I'm curious if regenerative, like, works better in a perennial versus an annual system, or if it's, you know, or if it works differently, or if, you know, what kind of differences you find in the data.
I think perenniality is a really important aspect of a regenerative food system. But I don't think that it precludes, or being regenerative precludes, annual production. I think integrating the two together is a pretty powerful provides pretty powerful outcomes, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of opportunities there.
Yeah, agreed. Well, and you have been, I mean, since I brought it up, you, one of your colleagues, Tommy Fenster, has done some work here in California and elsewhere with vineyards specifically. Is that right?
Yeah. So we have, we just finished our 3rd year of data collection for Tommy's doctoral dissertation. And I hope you'll talk to him about the nitty gritty of his data, because it's absolutely remarkable what he's been seeing out there in terms of sheep integration, and especially extended season grazing, and the impacts that's been having on the whole ecosystem and the productivity of those vines.
Wow. Do you know any of the data? Like, offhand, is there anything big that jumps out?
Yeah, I mean, well, greater carbon sequestration and soil health in general. You end up seeing more biodiversity in these fields. I have not gotten to taste the wine yet, but I'm looking forward to that.
If you need a scientist for that part of the study, just let me
volunteer
know.
On my hands, yep, do I?
I'm in.
Well, we've had wine from Piscinas, and yeah, that was delicious. That was their first crop, I think, that we got to taste.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. No, it's so far, I'm pretty convinced it's tasting great.
One of the interesting things, and this is something that we experience regularly, is when we got, in talking around, sheep integration has been kind of coming on, especially winter grazing in vineyards for a number of years. And we try to, with our graduate research programs, we try to focus them on what's next. And we thought, well, in vineyards, because Tommy really wanted to work in vineyards, what's coming next in talking with the farmers is extended season grazing. And when we first got started, there was only like two of them that we really knew about. But by the time, this is the third year, Tommy's found dozens of people that are grazing, and a good chunk of those are actually extended season grazing in their vineyards. And so I don't know whether that's because they were always doing it under the radar screen and us being present and developing relationships within that community has kind of brought them into the light, or is it because things are changing?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, articles have been written about it recently about how it's almost like a trend, and, you know, people are using it as like a marketing gimmick too, to just have like pictures of sheep in their vineyard and things like that. Sure.
More power to them.
Yeah, great trend. Fully yeah. Support that trend. Yeah. Well, great. I really appreciate you sharing all this. Is there anything unusual that you're finding in your research? Like anything?
We're dealing with quantities of data that really have never been collected at this
so
scale
in
our food
all
system.
Unusual.
So there's, yes, will there be unexpected findings? Absolutely. One of the things that we've, so this experiment was designed to, you know, measure farms, right? And so I'm a data guy, and that's what this was about, was gathering the data, right? That's what's important, data. Yeah. And what I didn't realize was just how important the way that we're collecting this data is to our success. A lot of times regenerative farmers are going out on a limb, right? They're bucking the system, and they're oftentimes, you know, they're chastised by their community or even their families, and they're working their asses off, and they just want to know that somebody gives a shit.
Yeah.
And in pulls this caravan of old crappy minivans and pours out these enthusiastic, people that come out and start measuring their farms and think that this farm is about the coolest thing that they've ever seen in their lives. And how important that is for just making farmers that are risking so much feel heard and seen. And, we'll go into an area and we won't know anybody. And by the time we leave that ecoregion or cluster, people are meeting us when we arrive with cookies or lunch or, you know, things that they've made on their farm that they want to share with our team. And it feels like, you know, the old country doctor who, you know, delivers a baby for a goat or something like this, or two hens. I mean, this is the style of science that we're doing at this point, right? We're getting eggs and, gosh, from the North Dakota trip, we came back with so many steaks and pounds of ground beef from those rangelands up there. And it's great, right? I mean, but that was totally unexpected. Totally unexpected to think that our presence actually mattered to those farmers.
That's great.
Yeah.
You know, on the Ecdysis website, I noticed you have a database of underrepresented groups in agriculture as well. I thought that was really unique to see that. And
yeah, that's been a real priority for us, is working with BIPOC and women owned and operated farms. And especially so for a number of reasons. Number one is I think there's a lot to learn there, especially from indigenous food systems and stuff. I think, you know, inherently they evolved to be quite regenerative. Mm-hmm. But what's also been interesting is because of the inequity and that's often present within our food system, there's a lot of old white guys. There's BIPOC farmers have really had to, in a lot of cases, abandon some of their ancestral food production strategies in order to adapt to this new world. And when they do so, they're left high and dry. And so we're able to kind of come in and support those farmers as well. And in some cases, introduce or reintroduce or validate what the way they used to produce food, you know, right. and which is a strange thing that, you know, that they abandoned it to begin with, but I totally understand. But here we are. So those are two different elements why I think it's so important for us to be a presence there. But it's been going really great. We love that. We've learned so much from that.
Well, I mean, you talked about how regenerative agriculture could revitalize our agricultural communities. How do you see that happening? I mean, what are the mechanisms by which that happens? I'll stop there.
Connecting with the natural world, with our families, with our communities, I think those are how that happens. You know, I think that one of the most important things is how does regenerative ag do this, I guess? By connecting farmers with the land and with their communities and changing culturally how we approach, you know, our interface with our communities and with the natural world, that becomes a really inherent basis of a sort of a cultural shift back towards having a lot more farmers and growing smaller and better rather than larger and simpler. So I think that's how this happens, is that it returns people to the land. It returns people to connecting with their food and understanding where their food comes from and the benefits of that. I don't know.
Yeah. But,
in a nutshell, I think that's true. We could talk for a long time about that. But.
Yeah. I mean, it's just been on my mind of thinking about resilience. I mean, maybe it's just my, future doom fear mind that, you know, sometimes rears its ugly head. And I think about, like, you know, how I and people I care about will deal with whatever comes, you know, you know, hopefully nothing terrible, but, you know, there's a lot of potential for terrible things to happen. And I keep coming back to community as really one of the most crucial and overlooked parts of resilience of anybody.
Yeah. I think it totally is.
I mean, I just think, how I've gotten through tough times in my life. And I, you know, I think about the way that when, you know, we all just got through this pandemic, or the COVID response. I hope that is something that I can build as well. Yeah. With that.
Yeah. We, our next hope with Blue Dasher Farm is picking up some of the neighbors' land as they start to retire, not for ourselves, but to break it up into several parcels that we can then do a rent-to-own agreement with some new farmers that we can strategize as far as what they're producing and work together towards and establish a food stand or whatever, where we're producing a lot of the products that people would use on a daily basis amongst this cluster of farms, and show the community, or rather the people in this region, that the way that you build community isn't with a new CAFO or a hog plant or a kill plant or something like this. It's through growing food for the people that you care about and the people that are close to you. So that's my in my spare time, that's one of the things that we'll be developing for the farm. When I'm wearing my farmer hat, that's one of the goals that I have to pursue.
Yeah, what percentage of the year are you traveling?
Summers end up being busy. And I do travel more than I like. I don't particularly care for traveling. I like to be at home and get shit done. But it's also necessary. And don't get me wrong. I love meeting the farmers and seeing this beautiful country. We're seeing a nation's food system on a pretty intimate level, really by a research team, kind of for the first time. Nobody's ever really done anything like this before. That's pretty remarkable, but boy, there's a lot of days that I just wish I could, look at bugs and chase sheep on the farm, you know.
You just identified your millionth bug. I saw.
Yeah, well, we're up to about 1.2 million now that we've identified. We've developed a whole new artificial intelligence system that can identify insects. So it's a really powerful tool for us. So we've been digitizing all of the invertebrate collection that we have and training our AI to be able to identify all these things.
And I feel like we should say that both Blue Dasher and Ecdysis are nonprofits. Is that true?
Blue Dasher is an LLC. It's an LLC. Okay. Farm, but gotcha. Ecdysis is a 501c3. We fund all this through crowdfunding. This is nuts, right? What's happening with this thing is just, this is crazy. So we're really super.
Well, yeah. I can't imagine somebody not wanting to support what you're doing. So I think it's worth mentioning that they can by simply donating.
That would be huge. It costs us about $7,500 to run each of these farms.
Yeah.
So you get this, you get an idea of the scale of what we're talking about here. I mean, these are really well studied farms, but they also, it ain't cheap, but somehow we're making this work. So.
And that's ecdysis.bio, is that right? Or am I?
Yeah, www.ecdysis, ECDYSIS, ECDYSIS.bio.
Great.
Look us up. Cool. Spread the word.
Nice. Well, any new things, any closing words that are, maybe new on your mind that's fascinating, that is really like a burning thing that you feel like we should all be thinking about and know about?
I have seen every member of our staff has seen a dust storm within the last 2 years, right? The likes of which we haven't seen since the 1930s. I've seen most of the country burning or flooded. We've watched this happen, right? There's gloom and doom everywhere. But I am absolutely filled with so much hope right now because of these farmers that we are meeting and what they are doing within their communities and how they're connecting and solving problems. This is the future, and the future is so damn bright right now. So that is not a message that you get by following this mainstream media, but I think it's one that we really need to be sharing with each other right now.
Yeah, well said. Well, thank you so much for sharing it. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for...
Hey, thanks so much for listening. I hope John's message moved you as much as it moved me. I especially loved when he mentioned how those of us who are farming wine should be growing more than just wine. One of the huge advantages of perennial fruit crop systems, be they vineyards or orchards or what have you, is that they can have multiple stories of crop production and can be grown in the context of a polyculture system very easily. In fact, we miss out on significant potential for the health of our wine the health and deliciousness of our wine if our farms only farm just wine. And actually, in the next episode that you definitely don't want to miss, it's someone who thinks about wine as one small part of a diversified farm context. So check that out. Also, I'm still thinking about the terroir of mead. There are so many potentials here. Honey changes color and flavor as often as the flowers change seasonally or, you know, monthly. You could make a different mead for every season and every month during the growing season. And they'd all be unique and unique to your bees. And I've been thinking about how you can just save the honey and make the mead during your slow times when it's not harvest, when it's you're not in this rush and crush. And so fermenting honey actually gives you this beautiful terroir expression that fits into a sane and healthy lifestyle that doesn't stress you out as well. Anyway, more reasons to love bees and honey and mead. And don't be surprised if there's a terroir of mead episode in the future. My book recommendation is Barons, with the subtitle Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry by Austin Frerich. You know, people have called the current era the Anthropocene. And the idea behind this, you know, it's the new era that started after the Holocene. And the idea behind this is that humans are causing the massive changes that we're living through. But are we? Or let me ask this a different way. Are all of us causing these changes? Could the word Anthropocene spread the guilt for our current crises too broadly? I've also heard the term Capitalocene used in an effort to narrow the focus of the blame to the ideas and values held by only a portion of the world's humans that are causing these changes. But is it really capitalism, or is it greed and selfishness? These questions have been the backdrop for massive global conflict, so I'm not going to answer them here, but I do know we've reached a point where it's time to start calling out bad actors. In Barons, Frerich names 7 corporations who control our food system. I'm just going to jump in and say, do you know Smithfield? If you've eaten pork from the grocery store, you've basically given money to Smithfield. If you haven't heard of Smithfield, they are the largest pork producer in the United States. They're much bigger than the United States, though. They aren't even from the United States. Smithfield is a Chinese-owned multinational corporation, which Frerich describes as using the U.S. as, quote, an extraction colony, end quote. Have you heard of Cargill? Cargill is one of the largest, baddest companies in the world. In fact, it has been named the worst corporation in the world, and it controls what you eat and use on a daily basis and how it's produced. Congressman Henry Waxman has said, quote, in contrast to the oil and tobacco industries, for instance, the bad practices documented here are not inherent to the products Cargill sells and are in fact entirely avoidable. For example, perhaps Cargill's largest negative impact on the natural world is its role in driving the destruction of the world's last remaining intact forests and prairies, end quote. Cargill, in other words, is willfully and knowingly destroying our home's vital ecosystems. And they are so huge that we've all supported them. Like, there is no question, you have not given them money. They continue to cut down huge areas of the Amazon rainforest in Brazil to produce soy that feeds the global meat production. If you've ever bought meat from a grocery store rather than your local farmer, you've supported Cargill. They are also slashing and burning the rainforests of Southeast Asia to produce palm oil. So if you've ever used basically anything with an ingredients list or that comes in packaging from the grocery store, you've supported Cargill. Palm oil is what's in your donuts and french fries. It's what your soaps, shampoos, conditioners, and cosmetics are made with. It's what's in your Oreos and Ritz crackers. Basically anything, like I said, with packaging or an ingredients list. And it supports the worst corporation in the world. Chocolate? Yep, sorry to say it, but your chocolate was produced by Cargill, often using child labor. If you've ever eaten at McDonald's, that's Cargill. If you've ever eaten at a restaurant that isn't entirely farm-to-table, Cargill. Have you heard of JBS? If you've eaten meat and not known the farm it came from, you've supported JBS. They are the largest slaughter and meat processing company in the world. So, you know, Cargill feeds them and JBS slaughters them. They are entirely corrupt. They are a known monopoly who the U.S. is not only allowed to exist. In 2018, we actually gave them bailout money of close to $23 million, which is especially strange when you realize they are a Brazilian-owned company. So why are we giving them bailouts? But maybe not so strange when you look at our political leadership in 2018. These are just three examples of the companies that we know are destroying our world that Frerich discusses in Barrons. They've been allowed to exist and control our food system, seize and maintain power, and kill any competition because of corruption. And they have created the landscape that John Lundgren saw that inspired him to want to start Ecdysis and change the world for the better. And it's time to stop these corporations. It's time to stop these people. We've done it before, and I'm excited to consider that we're in an age of correction, an age of reestablishing justice. If you're studying law, consider antitrust law. If you have money, consider putting it toward funding a costly lawsuit to break up a monopoly rather than start a winery. Honestly, we need more antitrust lawyers than we need new winery owners. Think of that legacy. We need rock star lawyers and some crazy rich folks who want to make this world a better place for everyone. We should all know who Lena Khan is and want to be her when we grow up. And let's all start becoming students of history. How did we defeat the robber barons of the 19th century? And what do we know about the Gilded Age? These topics can be part of our discourse, and I think there are valuable lessons to be learned from history. And the 2020s have a lot in common with the 1920s, so I hope we all get pissed off enough to take action to regenerate our world, starting with our food and beverage production. Personally, I'm thinking a lot about the fact that I financially support Jeff Bezos' Amazon, but I don't support any organizations that protect and restore the real Amazon, the forest that we rely on for life on Earth. And I'm thinking about which of those two Amazons is more vital to my existence. I have a vision of a cultural shift where we wake up from all of the marketing that glorifies being an ostentatious consumer and start being shocked by the wastefulness of our culture. This vision goes a lot deeper than I can go into now and maybe a little poetic and deserving of like a little more thought than I have time to give in this book recommendation, but I hope that you check out Barrons by Austin Frerich, and I'll have a great book recommendation for you on the next episode as well. Thanks so much for listening.